Content warning. Discussions of violence, war, torture and death that some people may find disturbing.
Welcome to the Newcastle Witches podcast. Thank you for listening. This is episode 3, Civil Newcastle, part 1. This episode is dedicated to Jane Hunter. Hello and welcome to the Newcastle Witches podcast. I'm Maria.
And I'm Caitlin.
And we're joined by David Silk, the learning manager at Newcastle Castle. David is a storyteller and historian, and he has a master's in medieval history from the University of Glasgow. Thank you for joining us, David. It's very nice to have you here with us.
Lovely to be here.
Thank you for joining us, David. So you're here today to help us talk about Newcastle and try and understand what was going on during the time period for the witch trials to take place.
Yes, so just to give a bit of background on Newcastle in the middle of the 17th century. It's quite an eventful century, really, for Newcastle. So Newcastle, during the time of the English Civil War and a little bit before, it's the largest town in northern England, certainly north of York. So it's a fairly substantial town, but it would be quite small by modern standards, I think. So we estimate the population generally it's somewhere around 10 to 12,000 in the whole town. It's still very much basically the medieval town. It's surrounded by a high stone wall built in the 1300s to keep the Scots out during the wars in the Middle Ages. And while there are sort of suburbs starting to grow up outside the town walls, that's still primarily the boundary of the town. So people are crammed into this fairly small space. The walls run between, the west walls are still visible around Chinatown in Newcastle alongside Stowell Street. Mm-hmm. And they run to the east, roughly around Pandon, around Manners Metro. And north from the river run up to about the monument. Not a huge area. It's really just the centre of modern Newcastle is the space that the town occupied. There are a few suburbs outside, but a lot of what we now regard as Newcastle were really just small villages on the outskirts of the town. So things like Benwell, Fenham, Elswick, Walker, Bycombe, Gosforth, all of these places were separate villages. They were outside Newcastle. Now they've been kind of absorbed by the urban sprawl, I guess, as it's kind of spread out from the walls.
Oh, okay.
But it's a fairly small, contained town. And it's still basically, with that wall around it, it's still effectively a fortress. I mean, the walls are huge. One of the things that's said at the time of the Civil War is that there are no walls to compare to them in Britain. And the only walls that the author can think of, I think this is Lithgow, who's the Scotsman who writes about the Civil War siege of Newcastle. He says that the only walls he's seen to compare to them are the walls of Jerusalem or Constantinople.
Oh, wow.
They're pretty big, though. I mean, they are.
Yeah,
like,
that's no small wall.
Yeah, it is a fortress town, a sort of frontier place. In the early part of the 1600s, certainly Newcastle was still part of the wider borders region, which was a pretty lawless part of northern England and southern Scotland. So a pretty dangerous place to live for the most part. It had become a little bit more peaceful with the union of the crowns in the first half of the 17th century. So some of those tensions, some of the danger and things had started to kind of simmer down a little bit, I suppose, by the 1630s. But it's in the 1630s, really, that Newcastle has its first outbreak, I guess, of bad luck. And outbreak is the word. But 1636, Newcastle has a devastating plague outbreak. In the 1630s. The plague is kind of one of those things that is, I guess, endemic rather than a pandemic by that period. So it first appears in Europe in the 1300s, wipes out about a third of the population of Europe in a few years, and then kind of simmers down and keeps popping up again in the background. There are repeated plague outbreaks throughout Europe in the 14, 15 and 1600s. Really famously, there's the big one in London in the 1660s. Yeah. But in 1636, Newcastle has an outbreak which seems to spread from North Shields, the port. It's where lots of sailors and things are coming in. So it seems to be carried in from there. And over 1636 and into 1637, We're told that the plague is raging in Newcastle. That's the way that they describe it. Rageth like wildfire. And they talk about it kind of sweeping through the town and sweeping the population away. Within the space of 1 year, about 6,000 people are killed.
And that was of a population of about 12,000 people, you said before, wasn't it?
Yeah, so roughly 50% of the population. They say that grass grew in the streets because there was nobody out on the streets. The town was basically emptied of people. If you had the money and the ability to flee, you fled. Those who couldn't were often quarantined in their houses, or there was a quarantine hospital built on the town moor as well, where people were locked in to keep them from moving around the town and spreading the plague. We've got reports from, a lot of our evidence for this period comes from a guy called Ralph Taylor, who's a scrivener, which is basically somebody who can write, but that's a profession in the 17th century because it's such a rare talent, rare skill really, that you know, he writes things for people. And he's going around taking down people's wills through their windows. They're sort of shouting things out at him. And he's literally walking around the streets with people dictating their wills to him. There are no lawyers left to do that. They've all gone to the countryside where they can hide themselves away from the plague. But Ralph is still there, kind of taking down people's wills as the plague rages through the town. And yeah, I mean, a 50% mortality rate is... it's enormous. It's kind of unthinkable to us nowadays. I don't think we can really grasp what that would feel like. But I think, you know, having lived through a global pandemic, we at least have some point of reference now for the plague, really, and what people must have felt. They had no idea how this was really being spread, other than person to person, or what caused it. Ministers in the churches were saying that this was God's judgment on Newcastle, that this was God's judgment on the world for people's sins. Others had more scientific explanations, but scientific explanations at the time were things like that it was spread by miasmas, sort of clouds of bad air that floated through the towns periodically and spread disease and plague. But it must have been a serious trauma, I think. I think it would be crazy to assume anything else. You know, this must have been a massive trauma for the people living in the town and who survived through this.
I mean, that's essentially an entire family is just wiped off the face of the earth. Just...
yeah, I mean...
disappearing. Your neighbours, your friends.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say half of everyone you know in the town, essentially. And families would be quarantined together. So if you were locked in your house as part of the quarantine, even if you didn't have the plague to start with, that was probably you finished, you know. You would catch it at some point, being locked in close quarters with people who did have it.
It's kind of unthinkable as well. Like you can't, like you said before, you can't really understand what people would have been going through. Like they were dictating their wills through windows. But also, to lose that many people, that was about 20 years prior to the actual trials happening and the execution, wasn't it? So the people who would have been alive in Newcastle probably survived the plague?
Yeah. Or they were people who came in from outside the town to repopulate it, I suppose. So I guess when there's a big shortage of workers like you have after that, people move in from the surrounding areas to find work and things like that. So we know there were a lot of, I think there were a lot of Scots, for example, living in places like Benwell and Elswick in that period, working as miners out in the villages. I suspect a lot of those people would have found themselves back in the town as well. So they'd either be newcomers without the same, I guess, family ties to the population, or yeah, they'd be people who'd survived that, who'd lived through that. And I think not having any scientific explanation for why that's happened, and we see it even now, people grasp around for sort of conspiracy theories to explain why this kind of thing is happening to them. And we've seen plenty of that in the modern day as well. So again, I don't think people then were really that different from us. They were grasping around for something to explain this. And as I say, the preachers a lot of the time latched on to this idea that this is God's vengeance, God's judgment on a sinful world, that they're somehow punishing people or wouldn't allow this to happen unless there was some wickedness going on in Newcastle that he didn't approve of.
I mean, it makes sense as well, them moving in from different areas. Thinking of a lot of Northerners and like other Geordies that I know, they do have a lot of Scottish roots, or they have like roots of a kind of northern town. So kind of makes sense, especially when you're saying how small Newcastle was. I was thinking before, like how small it was, and then to lose that much of the population, how on earth did they kind of get so big again?
Oddly, the plague doesn't seem to have done like really any long-term economic damage to the town at all. I mean, there's no real evidence that the town is severely economically damaged by this. It's still a merchant powerhouse of the north of England. And for all that sounds like a small town, 12,000 people, this really is kind of the metropolis of like Northumberland and County Durham. It's much bigger than Durham, for example, which is a city because it has a cathedral. But Newcastle, even though it's only a town, is the largest settlement north of York, really, before you get to Berwick.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's larger than Berwick in this period as well, really. So it's a big draw for people coming in. There's a lot of money being made, and it is really a merchant town. That's the other side of it. As well as being this kind of fortress surrounded by a wall, it's a port which has a lot of trade coming in and out. Originally, wool was Newcastle's big export in the Middle Ages.
Okay.
As it was for most of England, actually. But by the 16th century, coal has become the thing. And Newcastle actually has a monopoly on the coal trade in the north of England. So if you mine coal in Northumberland, you have to bring it into Newcastle to ship it. You're not allowed to ship from any of the other coastal villages or towns. Newcastle has a royal monopoly, which was, I think, originally granted by one of the King Edwards in the Middle Ages, when coal wasn't really a particularly big commodity. But they'd obviously maintained this monopoly with successive kings and queens. I know Elizabeth I confirmed their monopoly over the coal trade, and they'd really used that. The merchants who ran the town had really used that to grow very, very wealthy.
I do remember reading a quote somewhere that prior to the witch trials, Newcastle had been mentioned to be like one of the best places to live, that it was one of the most profitable. That was quite emerging prior to the Civil War. Was like seen as like up there with London because there was kind of so much there for people and there was a lot of ways to make money, or just you could make a lot of money.
Yeah, I think if you were part of the merchant class, the people they call the burgesses, the sort of free men of the town who have all these sort of rights that merchants from outside don't have, which they very jealously guard. I think, yeah, there was a lot of money to be made, particularly in the coal trade. As I say, there was this group at the top called the Hostmen of Newcastle. I think because they hosted visiting merchants in their homes and things like that. But they were a kind of cabal, I suppose, who ran the corporation, which was effectively the town council. But they elected the mayor of the town, the sheriff of the town and things like that. So the various town officials collected taxes, all that kind of thing. And yeah, I think there was a lot of money to be made. And yeah, Newcastle is frequently compared to places like London. It's, again, that idea... It can be misleading to say that it's a small town. Everywhere was a small town by modern standards in those days. Only London really had a significant population in England up until this kind of early modern period is where you start to see big urban growth starting at all. Prior to that, you know, you've got London, York, places like Bristol are quite large. But I mean, towns like Boston and Lincolnshire and stuff are still fairly significant ports in this period. So places that now are just like villages, really, or small towns, can kind of. So Newcastle, yeah, is really kind of punching above its weight as an economic.
Love to see.
Typical Geordies, isn't it?
Well, yeah, they're very entrepreneurial people. I think the people living in Newcastle in those days certainly, and it was all around that that kind of mercantile drive. That's really what they were making the money on. It's taken advantage of Newcastle as a port, and that's to the detriment of a lot of the smaller towns around Newcastle as well. So places like Sunderland, to an extent even as far as Hartlepool, but North Shields and South Shields especially, were the people there seem to have felt very hard done to, that they kind of weren't as major a port as you might imagine. They're right there on the coast. Newcastle is quite a few miles inland, but ships were kind of forced by this monopoly, really, to come upriver to Newcastle. And they would often kind of moor around North Shields and then come upriver to Newcastle to unload their goods on the quayside and trade with the merchants there who had this this right to kind of unload ships first and have first dibs on anything that was being sold.
Is this, I could be wrong, Ralph Gardner, who wrote the account of the witch trials, what he wrote it in was about the coal trade, wasn't it? And about how he didn't agree with how it was being practiced.
Yes. So, I mean, this is kind of, where I was kind of coming to with that, I suppose, is trying to bring Ralph Gardner into the story. He's such an important source for the witch trials. He is really our only major source of exactly what happened during the witch trials in Newcastle. And it is always important to remember when you're doing any kind of historical work, you've got to interrogate your sources. Who are these people? What do they want? What's their book actually about? Because his book is not about the witch trials. Like you said, it's about the coal trade. He is trying to convince Oliver Cromwell, who after the Civil War, of course, is the head of the government. He's the Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. He's trying to persuade him that the corporation in Newcastle are corrupt and that this monopoly should be stripped from them and allow the smaller towns to trade in coal and to prosper in their own right. And in doing so, he's trying to kind of show that these people are, as I say, sort of corrupt. And so when he talks about the witch trials, it's as part of a broader attempt to paint Newcastle as this kind of quite authoritarian place, I suppose. He talks a lot about other punishments that the town corporation has available to it for lawbreakers, which includes things like the scold's bridle.
Just for anyone who might not know, can you? I've seen a picture, but can you describe the scold's bridle for people? Because I don't think everyone kind of knows what it is.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to look at the original one, the original Newcastle Branks, as they called it, the scold's bridle, is in the Discovery Museum. You can go and actually look at it. But it's basically a kind of metal cage that fastens over a person's head. It can be locked in place, and it has a large kind of protruding piece of metal that sits on top of the tongue of the person who's wearing it. So it kind of presses down on your tongue. The idea is to prevent you from speaking. But I mean, the whole thing is designed to humiliate you. Some evidence, I believe. In fact, I think it was Joe, who you've had previously on this podcast.
Yes, lovely Joe Bass.
Yes, who told me that there was some evidence that they were sometimes painted in sort of candy stripe colours and things like that for people being dragged through the town wearing these. And the idea is to humiliate you as well as, you know, symbolically kind of silencing you. Symbolically and literally, obviously, but for the time that you're wearing it, it's kind of silencing you with this. Some even had spikes that sat over the tongue so that you would kind of stab your tongue if you tried to talk or lift them. It is a really horrific bit of kit.
I'm not sure where you get the imagination to have that. We're like, I know what we should do.
They were very creative back then. I think to some degree they were a bit bored. So they'd be like, what can we do to make this as horrific as possible?
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, this is the era, to some extent, this is kind of era of the rack and things like that as well. So, they were creative when they were being unpleasant to people. Yes, it has a certain power to it. You know, it's a nasty looking thing, which was used to punish usually women who were considered scolds. So like gossiping or arguing with people that they shouldn't have been arguing with, which generally, of course, means men.
It always means men. It's usually men that call people a gossip. That's what I've noticed.
Well, yes, it is one of those things, isn't it, where it's like, yes, men never gossip. That's not something that you would usually say about a man.
No.
It's kind of the same, you know, a man might be talkative, but like, yeah, it's a very gendered sort of thing. I mean, that was a big part of society in the 17th century. You're looking at a society which is very heavily gendered. There's a big divide between the rights and privileges available to people of different genders. Women usually didn't inherit, or at least weren't preferred in inheritance, usually didn't run their own businesses and things of that sort. And particularly strong women could do all of those things, but it was very much frowned upon. And that's, I mean, another thing that feeds into the witch trials, really, is that we're looking at a time period where increasingly people are becoming kind of very conservative about the way that they view gender roles and the roles of women. And, you know, we hear a lot about how women are the kind of weaker vessel and more vulnerable to the devil and his wiles, his temptations and things like that. The scold's bridle is, obviously a less grim punishment than being hanged as a witch, but it very much shows that kind of idea that the laws in the country, certainly in Newcastle, were heavily gendered and were heavily weighted against women, really. He does also talk about a few other slightly more comical-seeming punishments to us, like drunks were apparently made to wear a barrel over their head and various kind of things like this.
You say that as a punishment, but again, I've been out in town, and like that doesn't seem that uncommon to see someone in town doing.
Kind of like a stag do, isn't it? Like,
yeah. I don't think we ever lost that.
It's one of those strange. I think it's common in the Netherlands, but it appears in England only in Newcastle, as far as I know. This
that's really odd.
The drunkard's cloak that they seem to have imported. And again, Gardner's trying to say, you know, oh well. These people are as bad as the Dutch. The Newcastle Corporation, you know, they're kind of cruel and wicked to their own citizens. So we do have to bear that in mind when we read his accounts of the witch trials. He's not somebody who doesn't have an agenda.
He has an agenda.
He very much has his own agenda, and he's very much driven by that.
He's against the corporation, right?
Yes.
He does not like it.
So he's very much putting the blame for the witch trials on the corporation. And largely, I suppose, not absolving, but the wider population isn't mentioned quite so much in that. So Gardner, and that it gives a bit of the sort of economic background certainly to the area, and the Civil War itself obviously looms quite large in all of this as well. So
that's the end of Civil Newcastle Part 1. Tune in for Part 2, where David will speak to us about the Civil War in Newcastle and the impact it had on the city and the people.
Please find us on social media, come and say hello. We're on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook as the Newcastle Witches Podcast. Thank you for listening.